to walk the road of peace, sometimes we need to be ready to climb the mountain of conflict.
Tommy said, Mr. President, you're wrong. Now that takes a lot of guts.
I'm for peace and quiet, Mr. Lute. It's why I came to the UN. Quiet diplomacy.
And welcome to A Foreign Affair, where we take a fresh look at some of the key international developments that we think have flown under the radar a bit. This month, we're turning our gaze a little closer to home and to some subtle shifts that are having a big impact. Joining me on the panel this October are the ANU's Indonesia expert, Greg Feely, the senior lecturer at the Asia Institute of the University of Melbourne, Dr. Jay Song, and Dr. Stanley Rosen, a political science professor specialising in Chinese politics and society at the University of Southern California, and co-editor of the upcoming book Soft Power with Chinese Characteristics, China's Campaign for Hearts and Minds. Dr. Feely, Dr. Song, Professor Rosen, welcome to you all.
Thank you, Geraldine.
Thank you for having us.
Now, listeners may recall the shocking terrorist attacks, truly shocking, that took place in Surabaya in May last year, because suicide bombings were carried out by three families, parents including their children, one just 9 years old. Prior to this attack, Indonesia had long been struggling with rebel groups, as we know, particularly the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Jamaah Islamiyah and IS, which had been recruiting in the region. At the time of these attacks, which IS did claim responsibility for, you had this to say on Al Jazeera's Inside Story, Dr. Feely.
The police figures over the last few weeks have been that around about 1,100 Indonesians have gone to Syria and Iraq, and somewhere in the order of 500 have been sent back or returned to their own volition. It's a massive task for the police to properly monitor those hundreds of returnees. Not all of them will return to jihad, but even if you've had half of them doing so, well, then that would be a very serious security problem for the Indonesian state.
Well, now convulsions in Syria are raising fears of a new surge of IS militants flowing out of the Middle East and back into Southeast Asia, especially after hundreds of IS-linked detainees appear to have escaped from a Kurdish camp earlier this month. So, Greg, do you think we could see more seasoned foreign terrorist fighters making their way back to Southeast Asia? Is it a significant problem?
It's definitely a very real threat to the region. We don't know the details of some of those people who have escaped from the jails, but they could well include very experienced, extremely hardened jihadists from that battle that's been taking place in Syria and Iraq. And states within Southeast Asia are better prepared now than they were a few years ago at trying to keep tabs on these people and control the flow of people through their borders. But nonetheless, these could well be very resourceful people. They could be using existing jihadist networks in Southeast Asia. And there's a very strong possibility that some of those people will end up back in our region.
I saw some quite disturbing pictures, really, of lots of young detainees wearing orange jumpsuits, and they were said to be as young as 14. Now, can I assume that the Indonesian state actually has tracked those sorts of people?
It tries very hard to track those people. But even for the returnees to Indonesia, one of the impressions of people who are working with them have is that some of the most difficult cases they're dealing with are in actual fact children. These are children who have known nothing except a strongly jihadist environment, a highly ideologized environment. And the children sometimes have far more implacable attitudes than what their parents have. And so for the government ministries and for the NGOs that are working with the returnee families, that is a longer term problem for Indonesia and every other country in Southeast Asia that has returnees.
Yes, I mean, earlier this month, a pretty vivid case occurred where Indonesia's chief security minister, Wiranto, well known to Australians, was stabbed by a member of a pro-IS group and ahead of Jokowi's inauguration for the second second term as president, dozens of suspects were detained under suspicion of potential terror plots. Now, Sydney Jones from the Jakarta-based Institute for Policy Analysis of Conflict, she believes that those events in northern Syria, Greg, will boost the IS brand among supporters who never even left Southeast Asia. Do you agree with this assessment? Might that have affected that man who stabbed Wiranto?
It's certainly a possibility, and Sydney Jones is one of the very best researchers on this subject. So when she says that, I think we all need to take it very seriously. What is clear from looking at what's appeared in the Indonesian media based on police statements and based on inside sources within the government is the man who stabbed Wiranto. It was a curious case and in some ways a rather concerning case because although he was involved in a group which was pro-ISIS, the Indonesian affiliate or the Indonesian partner organisation is called JAD. So this person, Abu Rara, was a member of that group, but he doesn't seem to have had any extensive training. But in this particular case, this amateur jihadism, this person hasn't been trained. He chose a very simple method to undertake the attack. There could be a great many people in Indonesia who look at this event who have a kind of terroristic intent and they say, well, we could do that as well. I'm sure this would alarm security services to see an attack like this. And if the jihadist had a little bit more knowledge about how to undertake this, he probably could have killed Wiranto with just one blow. So there are things that we should be grateful for, and his lack of nous in undertaking these kind of assassination attempts.
He is recovering, isn't he?
He is recovering. Yeah. He's apparently up and walking, but the injuries are more extensive than what was initially reported.
Just before we leave Indonesia, because we must talk about the other development that Jokowi, the president, has now appointed his former bitter election rival and ex-army general Prabowo Subianto as his defence minister, which has caused some unrest among Widodo's supporters. What do you make of this?
Well, there's certainly a lot of politics involved here. As with Jokowi's previous cabinet decisions, there's always this sometimes bewildering array of compromises taken place, but also single-minded pursuit by the president of a particular objective. So on the one hand, he has retained many of the key technocrats, particularly in the economic portfolios, the things that he really cares about above all else. He's, for the most part, kept good people in those critical jobs. But he has to lead a coalition of six parties now, and he has to find spots for all of those parties because politics in Indonesia is a very high-cost game. And if a party has a minister who can make senior appointments, who can channel funds indirectly towards party campaign coffers, well, then they are much better set up for the elections that they have to contest in the future. So it's really a patronage game. And sometimes people use the word cartel to describe the way in which successive Indonesian presidents have tried to embrace a broad array of political forces, bring them into the fold, let them have access to the resources that ministers can muster, and that way they will work with you rather than against you. And for Jokowi, what he cares about more than anything else is expediting Indonesia's rapid development and trying to limit the opposition to that. So part of the decision about Prabowo is to not neutralise Prabowo as a force, but to have him working with Jokowi to some extent rather than against him. We should also keep in mind, although, as you mentioned, they're quite bitter rivals in the last two presidential election campaigns. Between those two election campaigns, Prabowo very often provided welcome support for Jokowi when he was facing several crises. Prabowo could have sought to have worsened Jokowi's problems, but he chose not to. So Jokowi may feel as if when it comes down to it, he can rely on Prabowo. We'll see.
Now let's turn our attention to South Korea, where protests have returned to the streets of Seoul. This is Edward White reporting on the developments for the Financial Times.
It is just 3 years on from the massive candlelight revolution, which led to the downfall and imprisonment of former President Park. And now, the current leader Moon Jae-in has found himself in the biggest political fight of his presidency. The controversial pick of the man he wanted to be justice minister backfired and caused outrage among opposition groups as the minister's own family became embroiled in a corruption scandal.
Now, Dr. Jay Song, I think most listeners will not have heard about what's underway in South Korea. What's the scandal surrounding the justice minister that Edward White was referring to?
Yeah, South Korea is not like a Westminster system where the winning party forms a government in majority or in coalition, but it's more like an American system where the politically appointed cabinet members have to go through the parliamentary hearing, which is widely open and broadcasted to the general public. So in this case, Cho Guk, or Guk Cho in English, he used to be the South Korea's top university, Seoul National University law professor, who became the chief advisor to President Moon Jae-in on civil affairs. And his biggest agenda is law reform, especially the prosecutor's office, who has immense power in Korean politics. So when he was appointed as the justice minister, so he had to go through those parliamentary hearings where there's a lot of accusation made against him by the opposition party, which includes some of the university entrance exam, some favorable condition given to his daughter some 10 years ago, and some of the accusation was also related to his father's running of a school and his investment in private funds, fifth cousin's involvement in this funding schemes. So the younger generation especially who feel some frustration about the haves and have not in South Korea, they feel very frustrated because it's the sort of a left-leaning or leftist government agenda for law reform, and they're representing the so-called the working class or proletariat in South Korea. But when all this accusation came out, this justice minister appointee was just representing one of those haves, not the have-nots that
he was supposed to represent. Well, his daughter allegedly received scholarships over six consecutive terms. It's all to do with this business of it's not a fair and balanced playing field for merit and for talent. I mean, that's an extraordinarily corrosive impact, isn't it, on a society?
Yeah, that's why I think a lot of younger generation in South Korea is especially frustrated because the daughter of this politically appointed justice minister got this favorable condition, having received multiple scholarships, like you just said, and using, her parents' connection. She was doing some internships, but I don't think she faked her contribution to the academic activities or faking the internship. It's just that the whole hearing system is creating issues amongst those pro Moon Jae-in supporters. Because
do you mean the candidate when you put yourself up to be a candidate? Is that what you mean?
Exactly. The hearings is not just about the appointees himself or herself. How it's done is they're digging all, the parents and the siblings and the children's. So it's almost like a guilt by association, sort of a North Korean style. They don't look at the appointees' professional record in the past. They're digging all the family histories, what they have done in the internship certificate, whether the certificate was correct or fraud, or the parents' involvement, the running of the business, and the mother's involvement in this university.
Okay, so really what we're... this is very deep, isn't it? If you've got a perception that the rich and the powerful are sort of rigging access to merit, merit-based systems and potential. I mean, education is so favoured by Koreans that this really is going to the core of a value system, isn't it?
That's correct. I mean, Cho Guk's wife is now being arrested. There are 11 charges made against her, and that will indirectly and directly involve Cho Guk, the now resigned minister as well. Education is a big thing, and the current President Moon Jae-in's agenda is to do law reform, and the political tension between pro-Moon supporter and anti-Moon supporter who are all out now on the street in Seoul, the capital of South Korea, doing this divide between the it's not really left and right divide in Korea. It's more sort of a vertical divide between the haves and have-nots.
So, I mean, there was a similar scandal, as we heard on the clip, almost 3 years ago, which led to the downfall of the former President Park. And this was a whole part of President Moon's big promise that he would create a level playing field for all South Koreans. So how serious is this for him?
I don't think it's that serious. His support rate is still around 40%. And this Jo-guk incident, what many South Korean pundits call it, it's been used for the next general and also presidential election. It's opposition parties using the emotions of this younger generation's frustration to go against Moon. And the pro-Moon supporters also using this very incident to show the sort of, the cruelty of the prosecutor's investigation about the politically appointed cabinet members. But the Moon support rate is around 40%. It's actually gone up from 35 to 40% after this Jo-guk incident.
Okay, well, look, that's curiouser and curiouser, as Alice would have said. Now, let's move then a little across the sea to China, and let's listen to this.
You need to spend more time here with your family.
Ow, where are you going?
Be back before dinner.
Be careful out there.
No, boy.
Got it covered. Bye.
I just want to escape.
That was an excerpt of the trailer for the new animated film Abominable. It's a joint production of DreamWorks and Pearl Studios, which is based in Shanghai. It includes a scene showing a very controversial map of China. Visible is the infamous nine dash line, China's vague and ambiguously marked demarcation line for its territorial claim over most of the South China Sea. And that's a claim disputed by China's Southeast Asian neighbours. Now, the scene has sparked outrage in Vietnam and the Philippines and Malaysia, and it's really become a geopolitical nightmare for DreamWorks. It's also served to expose China's growing level of influence over Hollywood, which is a really interesting angle. Professor Stanley Rosen, it's been said that this dispute points to a new problem. Silence on China's nothing new, but positively pushing the Chinese government's view of the world surely is. Do you think this represents a bolder stance than we've seen in the past?
Well, I think this is in some ways a special case because Abominable is a co-production, and I would imagine that DreamWorks allowed their partner, Pearl Studios, which bought out DreamWorks from their original Shanghai investment, to pretty much anything dealing with China and Chinese politics, Chinese culture, they farmed that out to them. So I think in some ways it's a special case, but it's not just Abominable. ESPN, which is under Disney now, They also used a nine-dash line. It's a bit of a problem now, but one of the things I've discovered is you're getting more pushback against China as China's become more assertive in putting things like this in films. Hollywood, not just Hollywood, the NBA, for example, in the United States, are developing a bit of a backbone. The new Netflix film, The Laundromat, is a very interesting case. China hasn't said anything yet, but
What does it do? It shows this nine-dash line, does it?
No, it's not about the nine-dash line, but it's even worse in terms of offending China because it's based on a book about the Panama Papers and how wealthy people, including Xi Jinping's brother-in-law all over the world, sheltered their money. What's interesting to me in this case, an example of pushback against China, which I think is a story that hasn't been talked about much, was I've read the book and there's a whole chapter on China and how the so-called princelings, the well-connected elite, are able to use these tax shelters. But what's interesting about the film is that they add something which is not in the book, and that's Falun Gong, which is this...
Do they go there, do they?
They do, and they show organ transplants. Ooh. And even talk about how much money a heart is worth. They show very graphic descriptions of removal of corneas. I was shocked when I saw this film because it's the opposite of what Hollywood normally does to placate China.
Yeah. Hollywood faces a dual problem here, doesn't it? Because films are increasingly being bankrolled by China. And at the same time, Hollywood's studios are fighting for a slice of this extraordinarily fast-growing box office market, which surpassed the US in total revenue for the first time ever in the first quarter of 2018. So how are they going to resolve this?
Well, I would just note that was just that first quarter because of the Chinese New Year Spring Festival. They haven't yet surpassed North America on a yearly basis. The other thing I would point out is if you look, China is beginning to look at Hollywood in terms of the necessary Hollywood blockbuster films to fill seats in China as less important. If you look at the top 10 all-time hits in China. There's only one from Hollywood now, and that's Avengers Endgame. Mm-hmm. 2019 saw many Chinese films getting into the top 10 list, including patriotic films. So this relationship is undergoing some shifts at the moment. As you say, investment has become the most important thing for China, investing in Hollywood films. They wanted to buy a studio, they wanted to buy assets, and they have in the past, but now they can't do it anymore. There are capital controls from China and pushback from the U.S. Congress for national security reasons. So China is kind of much more limited in what they can do. They have to rely on Hollywood to self-censor themselves.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because we had our former, the head of our Department of Foreign Affairs, Francis Adamson, who is a very much a specialist on China, gave evidence yesterday at a big parliamentary inquiry into what she thought was, in effect, the new normal, where she said there will be, in her view, ongoing discussions about different value sets, differences between our systems and our values, and that's just not going to go away, and we're going to have to learn how to live with this, which I suppose happened in the Cold War as well. So it's not easy for Hollywood to learn how to live with that, is it?
No, in fact, I once wrote a short article called Is Hollywood Selling Out or Cashing In? And the two are in some ways the same thing.
Mm.
Have to somehow develop a balance between those things. The NBA is a classic example too. Adam Silver, the head of the NBA, basically has kind of developed enemies on both sides by trying to walk this fine line.
So where do you see this heading? Have you seen anybody doing it well?
No, not particularly. As you know, DreamWorks refused to eliminate that scene when Mahathir of Malaysia asked him to do so. ESPN has been extremely quiet about the NBA situation. Disney typically has said nothing about any of the controversies, including the new Mulan that's coming out in March 2020 with Crystal Liu Yifei, where she did a tweet supporting the police in Hong Kong against the protesters. Disney has remained silent on all of that. People just want people low profile. I hope it goes away.
Yes. Yes, these are the sorts of dilemmas people just are trying to deny, I suppose. Look, it's perfect in a way to close our foreign affair this month about soft power, the nature of soft power. I mean, Greg Feeley, I've noticed this week that the IS propagandists are reportedly trying to exploit the social media app TikTok as a recruiting tool. I just wonder whether you think that terrorist groups are using soft power well, which is a subset of what we've just been talking about in terms of the China-West relationship.
ISIS has been actually superior in the information war games, if I can put it that way. They have often outpointed Western governments in their success in conveying their messages to target communities. And this has been really a feature of ISIS almost since the start of the caliphate, or before the start of the caliphate, this sophistication that they've had in tailoring a wide range of messages that specifically target particular communities, whether they will be alienated Muslim youth in Western countries, whether they'll be people in the Middle East or in countries like Indonesia. They have been remarkably successful at doing so. And many of the people they've recruited to do this are people who have high technical skills and have been very creative. So that information war between ISIS and its enemies has been something that many observers believe ISIS has got the better of its opponents in.
Yeah, and I mean, this is just taking all of this out of the academy and into picture theatres and so on, which is what we've been talking about. And I was thinking, Dr. Song, that the inequality gap in South Korea, which is also playing out in all of those protests, that's become fictionalized very starkly in a number of South Korean TV dramas and movies. And there's a film on at the moment called Parasite, which depicts a family of destitute basement dwellers who try to climb the social ladder by leeching off the wealthy Park family. And that's attracted a huge amount of attention and audiences. So, I mean, do you think this is affecting the sentiments of young people and whether it makes them more inclined to go out onto the streets.
Yeah, Bong Joon-ho's Parasite is hugely popular, but I wouldn't compare South Korea's soft power led by People and K-pop and K-drama, K-film, and compare them with the ISIS or CCP control movie industry in that sense.
Yeah, it's certainly just a long way, isn't it, from the way in which hearts and minds were won. I suppose that's what I take out of this, Professor Rosen, that, you know, we're into this new world where it's used for great connections, but it can also be used for propaganda and for very definitely for changing whole sets of attitudes, can't it?
It certainly can. I think China may have gone a little too far recently in its assertiveness. I'm thinking of outside film as well, with the European Union just giving the Sakharov Prize for Freedom of Thought to Ilham Tohti, the Uyghur academic who has been imprisoned for life in China. People are pushing back now against China. So I think that's something to watch.
But the question is, will they make films? They're not yet, are they? They're not making films that are making waves in the West. I mean, that would be the real next step, but they're not doing that yet, are they?
Well, they're trying their best. I've lectured a lot in China on how to internationalize the Chinese film industry because they are spending a lot of money trying to get their films into Europe, North America, and so on, very unsuccessfully. There's a basic contradiction. Film is now under the control of the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party Propaganda Department as of the last year. So the ideological control is much tighter. They want films that compete with Hollywood on the global marketplace. At the same time, they want Chinese films to reflect what they call socialist core values, support the Communist Party. It's a basic contradiction they haven't been able to solve.
Mm. How fascinating. Professor Stanley Rosen, Dr. Jay Song, and Dr. Greg Feely, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
A pleasure, Geraldine.
Thank you.
And Dr. Feely's from the ANU, Dr. Jay Song from the Asia Institute at the University of Melbourne, and Dr. Stanley Rosen, a political science professor specialising in Chinese politics and society at the University of Southern California.